Colts quarterback Andrew Luck and best-selling author John Green.
Velvety.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Wow. Thank you all. Thanks for being here.
Great crowd. Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. All right. For my chaperones for the evening. I've actually never been in here with the lights on. It's always been like a pretty aggressive rock show.
Yeah.
Somewhere over
I've always
there.
Been standing up like 14 rows back, like getting pushed. It's much better.
I've usually been
seating.
In the bleachers. You should splurge for the bleacher seats next
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming tonight. I'm Andrew Luck, representing the Andrew Luck Book Club, and this is our podcast on the road, I guess. Thank you. And thrilled and honored to be joined by John Green, who I got a chance to meet at some Indy 500 festivities probably 4 or 5 years ago, and read a couple of your books, watched a couple of your movies, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's really awesome to be here. As you know, I'm a huge fan of the work that you do in the community,
Thanks.
And I just think this book club is awesome. It's getting so many new people to lots of different books. I love the books that you pick. It's such a broad range and reflective of your taste and your breadth as a reader, and I really love it.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And I'm not just saying that because you picked my book.
I appreciate it. Well, let's talk about that book. Let's get into that. We've got an hour, so we'll maybe meander around a little bit. But I do want to get into Turtles All the Way Down. I felt a lot of anxiety reading it.
Yeah.
A lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And was that the point?
It was, yeah. I mean, I wanted to write about... So there's this old problem in fiction and in language in general, I think, that it can't really describe pain very well. It's really
yeah.
difficult to approach descriptions of pain. And when we talk about physical pain, we often talk about it through simile or metaphor. We say it's like a stabbing pain. We describe it as like a hammering or something, because it's almost impossible to find language to describe it. There's this great writer, Elaine Scarry, who has this beautiful book, The Body in Pain. And in it, she writes that to have pain is to have certainty, and to hear of others' pain is to have doubt. And that bridge, because pain is so internal and abstract and deep down, the bridge between having it inside of you and communicating it effectively to someone else is a really difficult bridge to build, I think, with language. And that's what I wanted to try to do. You know, I wanted to try to write... I mean, I've lived with these... you know, at times terrifying, overwhelming, destructive, obsessive thought spirals since I was a kid. And what I wanted to try to do was find a way not just to talk about what it's like,
yeah.
But if possible, to talk about what it is so that the reader might at least glimpse what it would be like to be stuck inside of Aza's head.
Yeah, and so for those of you who haven't read it, Aza is a high school girl that lost her father at an early age. And has these thought spirals that trap her and almost pin her down and don't let her live. And she's got some interesting ways they manifest itself physically in a cut on her hand.
Yeah.
And I know it struck me to the core through my sort of injury and process over the past two, three years. And I felt a little bit of the same anxiety and stress. You mentioned pain, and that was interesting because for me, very difficult to communicate pain to anybody else. And I think you do an amazing job of sharing the anxiety and the nervousness and the lack of self-confidence in this girl. And you know, I was sitting there reading, and I was like, "Man, you're how old are you?"
40.
40. You're young.
Yeah. I mean. Not as young as you.
I guess. I was like, how does a 40-year-old dude write so eloquently and thoughtfully about what it's like to be a 14-year-old girl? And I felt it. I felt like
yeah.
you know, I was Aza in that story.
Yeah, I think, you know, this to me, the secret of writing is... from someone else's perspective, it's always an act of imagination. It's always, you know, an act of empathy, trying to imagine what it would be like to be someone other than yourself. For me, I need a point of connection, and with
yep.
Aza, it was that we have the same We don't have the same focuses of our obsessive worry, or we don't have the same compulsive behaviors, but we have the same problem. And then from there, it was just imagining what it would be like if instead of that stuff happening to me, it was happening to someone who had a very different set of life circumstances than I have. And, you know, I don't know how teenagers sound today, God knows, but I also didn't really know... I didn't really know what teenagers sounded like when I was 16. Like this will surprise you, but I wasn't like crushing it in high school. And so I think to some extent, like being on the outside, like feeling like I was on the outside of it even when I was a high school student, made me more of like an observer of language than a participant in it a lot of times. And so I've just tried to hold on to that, I guess.
Yeah, awesome. I really enjoyed the book. Also, the setting, Indianapolis. Also the setting for The Fault in Our Stars, if I'm correct. I remember
reading
that. Yeah. Okay. I had a worry of doubt for a second.
Oh, yeah. I've been there. Oh, yeah. Oh, man. I did that really badly once where I was interviewing an author, and I asked them about a book that they had not written. So I had all the facts about the book right, and my question was like 4 minutes long, you know, it had a lot of like preamble and side notes and as you'll recalls, and they didn't stop me, which I would argue makes it a shared blame situation, but yeah, it was brutal, and then I finally was like, what was your intent in that scene? And they were like, I did not write that book. So don't worry.
It's
not going to go that bad.
I feel better already. But it's set in Indianapolis, Pogue's Run,
yeah.
White River, talk about 86th Street,
yeah.
Driving the 465 ring.
Yeah.
Have you actually done that?
I have. I have driven.
Why?
So.
Research?
No. No, and this isn't that good of a story, but I have never told it, so... The only time, so I left, I was born in Indianapolis, my dad went to Brebeuf, my dad grew up here, but I had absolutely no relationship with this place. My parents moved when I was 8 weeks old, I knew nothing about Indianapolis, but for some reason I had a debate tournament here when I was in high school, and my debate teacher was like trying to drive us somewhere, and she missed the exit, and she was like, don't worry, it's a circle. And I don't know, like, how big she thought the circle was, but, like, it was, like, an hour and a half later. And I was like, I don't know that much about driving, but I feel like this can't possibly have been the most efficient way. So I have driven all the, but it's been a while.
That's funny. Yeah.
But, I mean, I love writing about Indianapolis. Like, I really love it because it's an American city in the best ways and the worst ways. It's sprawly. You know, it's got its problems for sure, but it also reflects a lot of what I love about American cities and American communities, the way the community can come together, celebrate stuff together. I just really like Indianapolis. I love the fact that we're on a non-navigable river. I just think that's so...
You mention it in the book.
I know. I get into it in, some would argue, too much detail. I just love that fact, and I think it's so resonant, and it says so much about the city that we've built in spite of our non-navigable geography. Yeah. I mean, it must have been weird for you because you didn't choose Indianapolis.
Yeah, Indianapolis chose me.
Yeah, like literally. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
But like, what's it, I mean, you're living in California, and you get the call, and you're like, okay, I'm going to Indianapolis.
Yeah.
I
knew for a while that I probably was going to end up in Indianapolis.
So you had like a few months to reconcile yourself to it.
No, there was no need for reconciliation. We had moved a lot. We moved a lot as a kid growing up, and so I think all my siblings and I have a bit of wanderlust in us, and a bit of. An appreciation for seeing things done a little differently so I was excited to come to the Midwest. I had an uncle who lived here for a couple years up in Carmel on the north side, and we were coming like as a high school kid to Purdue football camps.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, you know, NASA and Houston where I grew up, and I knew there was a bunch of astronauts from Purdue. So there's like little things that like that that got me excited about coming to that started hitting my brain and coming to this city. And it's a bit surreal. The draft is weird. The process of being sort of picked and placed on a team is odd, but I think it's also very cool and what's unique about American sports. I know we're both big soccer fans. We talk about it a lot, and that doesn't happen anywhere else. And I know I have some friends that are soccer players, some European guys, and they think that the draft is like the weirdest, coolest thing, and they get into it, and they they'll watch it. But it's been awesome living here. It's been fun. I've enjoyed it. I remember like the third weekend I was here, I was sitting up there literally, you know, watching a rock show. So this place is special to me as well in Indianapolis. Yeah. When's the next, when are we going to have a scene in the Egyptian Room? John Green
novel?
Well,
I mean, I don't feel like I'm done writing about Indianapolis, so maybe maybe it'll happen.
Yeah. There's a, reading the book, I had to go, when I was rereading it in preparation for this, the first time through, there was a detective on the case of Mr. Pickett, or Trickett, which one is it?
Pickett.
And I read Dwayne Allen the first couple times. And Dwayne Allen is an old teammate of
mine.
That
would have been cool.
But then I read back, it said Dwight Allen.
Dwight.
Was that your subconscious
talking? I missed an opportunity.
And there's a Simon who's the police chief.
Yeah, there's some little...
There's
some Indianapolis inside jokes a little bit. There's a... More than Indianapolis inside jokes, there's a lot of inside jokes about this teen band One Direction that I really...
Missed those.
Yeah. I mean, did you even read it? So I know you're a huge Directioner, so surely you couldn't have missed them all. Yeah, I got really... I'm really interested in the band One Direction, not like their music or anything, but the like... fan community that grew up around their music, because the stuff that the fan community makes is so good and so much better. I don't know if I should say this in public, but like I think it's better than the art that it's inspired by, and I'm fascinated by that, how like a work of art can be better than the work of art it was inspired by. But that's, I think that's often the case. So yeah, like all the car names are names of One Direction members, and the name of the zoologist is the name of a One Direction member. So sometimes I like to have like a properly good symbolic reason to name most of my characters, but then some of them I'm just like, yeah, this is a funny One Direction joke.
Is it funny? Just kidding.
Yeah, no, you saw the opening and you took it. That was the right decision. Yeah. You made the right decision.
You actually remind me of a One Direction story. Anthony Costanzo, our mutual friend,
yeah, great
and some
guy.
Of you may know that name, was at the One Direction concert here in Indianapolis, and he was sitting in the second row, and Anthony Costanzo is an absolute unit of a human being. He's like 6'8", you know, 350 pounds, long hair, and in the middle of the concert, the lead singer...
Harry Styles.
Stopped singing and pointed... At he said, hey, you big lad right there in the middle of the song, and Anthony sits down. What's going on? He's like, no, stand up. And so he stands up again. He said, you're the biggest man I've ever seen in my life. And Anthony wakes up the next morning and has something like 30,000 new Twitter followers, all of a certain age and demographic. But
right,
yeah.
Oh, man. Power of the fandom.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Pogues Run, I really like that reference. I've ridden my bike along there. I've been to the Pogues Run Co-op on the Near East Side.
I mean, that's one of the many things I find fascinating about Indianapolis is that we have a tunnel that runs underneath much of the city and underneath Lucas Oil. And
they're adding to it right now.
Yep. And it's you know, some people live there, especially near the beginning of the tunnel, but it's a fascinating walk. I've made the walk a couple times. It's almost 2 miles, and it's just very strange that we have this place underneath our city, and I like it for a few reasons, you know, that it is a kind of burial space, but also that it's a space that most people would find scary. that Asa doesn't find scary. And so through the whole book, you know, Asa's afraid of everything, and it's infuriating and it's exhausting that Asa can't manage her thoughts and she can't choose what to think about. But when they're in this place that everyone else would find scary, she's completely unfazed by it. And I wanted to make that clear, because it's not like people with OCD have a fear problem. They have an obsessive thinking problem. They can't control their thoughts. They can't stop their thoughts. And when most people, you know, everybody has weird thoughts, you know, like you're standing. There's some of them are so popular, they have names. There's one called the high place phenomenon, where if you're like standing at the edge of a bridge, you'll think like, oh, I could just jump. And then you'll take a step back and be like, that was a weird thought. And then you'll just like continue about your life. But like, the closest analog I can come to what obsessive thinking is like is you go to the edge of a bridge and you say, I could just jump off. And then you take a step back and you said, why did I have that thought? And then it's gone. Then like, once you've had the second thought about it, there's no escaping that thought spiral. And it tightens and tightens and tightens and tightens and feels like there's no escape from it. And it's terrifying, because you start to believe like, because if you can't choose your thoughts, it really undermines your sense of self, you know? If you can't choose what your thoughts, then, and your thoughts are at least part of what constitutes you, then, like, to whom does this you belong really? And that's what Asa finds so disorienting and scary.
Yeah, and if you have not read the book, I highly recommend it. And you do, again, you do an amazing job of making, I think, making the reader feel that in their bones. And you know, it's sort of a joke, but I really did feel anxious reading the book, and I did feel a lot of anxiety, and I did feel a lot of nervousness. It was actually, I did not enjoy reading it before bed. I couldn't. I'd start, like, you know, little sweats before going to bed and stuff.
Yeah, so. Good. Good.
Oh,
that makes
good.
Me happy. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know.
So you talk a little bit about fan culture around One Direction. In your story as well, there's a fan culture around Star Wars.
Yeah.
And Asa's best friend, Daisy, writes a series with some Star Wars characters. Is there a fan culture around John Green?
There is, yeah. I mean, not as much. The fanfic.
And how do you interact with it, I guess?
The fanfic of my books is not as extensive as Star Wars fanfic, which is a huge universe, you know, and it really is fascinating, and I fell way down the Star Wars fanfic rabbit hole while researching this book, and in some way it stopped being research, and it just started being that I enjoy Star Wars fanfic, which is not something I knew when I started the book, but it's something I know now. It's really, there's tons of great stuff, but the stuff written about my books, it mostly extends the lives of the characters outward, or it extends... you know, it imagines relationships between characters who maybe I didn't imagine that relationship for. And I have to say, it's so wonderful, and I'm so grateful for it. And I know some authors think fan fiction is bad, and that, you know, we own the copyrights or whatever. But I just think it's beautiful. I feel so lucky that somebody would care enough about one of my characters to imagine things happening to them outside the text of the book. Like, it's just so cool. And some of them are actually quite good. Like, there's this one that's written where these two characters from The Fault in Our Stars end up in a romantic relationship with each other, Isaac and Hazel. And at the end of it, I was like, I buy it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I buy it as a sequel.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really cool. And you mentioned for research, you got into fanfic of Star Wars. What other research do you typically do for a book? And specifically, I guess, Turtles All the Way Down.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the book, for sure. With Turtles All the Way Down, I wanted to be really sure that I got the mental health stuff right, you know, and that I approached it in ways that weren't going to be harmful. And so I talked to a lot of, a lot of people who work in that field and researchers in that field and that kind of thing, and read some books and tried to make sure that I was approaching it in a responsible way. And then I guess the other... you know, the other kind of deep research was into, the White River is so important in the book, and the way that it splits the city apart and kind of splits Asa's life into two parts. So I did spend a lot of time on the river, thinking about the river. What does it mean to have this really, you know, frankly, filthy waterway in the center of our city? You know, which, and I the great irony of the river is that if you've ever spent any time on it, it's absolutely beautiful, and there are there's an abundance of wildlife, and it's a world unto itself right in the middle of the city. But of course, you probably haven't spent any time there because it also has like a lot of raw sewage in it. And so, what makes the river so like what makes the river feel like you're in a wilderness preserve is precisely the fact that it is so deeply contaminated. And that's something I wanted, like, I think that reflects something about Aza's experience of herself and her body and her own fears of contamination, so I wanted to explore that. So I spent a lot of time on the river.
Yeah, cool. Very cool.
Didn't drink the water.
Or swim in it?
Oh, no. I'll let my kids like wade in the water, and last summer I saw my son like swimming away from me, and like his head went under for a second, and I was like, "Oh no!" He's fine.
Good. 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 Lost my train of thought there. Oh yeah. So you've had a couple books become movies.
Yeah.
A Chance This Becomes a Movie, and what's that experience like? Because I know, we were talking about this backstage earlier, I was crushed when the Harry Potter movies came out, and they pronounced her name Hermione, not Hermione. You know, it was what my mind said forever.
Right.
And I read The Fault in Our Stars after watching the movie, which is one of the few times I think I've ever done that in my life, and it was weird. Because I'd already had a picture of so much of it
in my head. The visuals are so powerful, right?
Absolutely.
Like, so when you read a book after watching the movie, it's almost impossible not to see those characters as those people. Like, I recently read the book Red Sparrow, which is based, and they made a movie about that, and I haven't seen the movie, but they put Jennifer Lawrence on the cover, and so I picture her when I'm reading the book. I'm like, I have mixed feelings about that. Obviously, there's a magic to a book that's only a book. There's a magic to a story that you can only interact with textually and that, you know, refuses to be adapted either because it's so famously unadaptable, like maybe Confederacy of Dunces, or because the author just says no.
Yeah.
I struggled a lot with it with Turtles All the Way Down, mostly because depictions in film or any visual medium of OCD, you almost always end up focused on the compulsions.
Yeah.
You know, you almost always see the person, Aza, picking at her thumb or whatever it is, because the compulsions are so weird and they're so visual. But in my experience anyway, these compulsive behaviors are used to manage the actual problem, which is the obsessive thoughts. And you don't see those as much because they're so profoundly abstract. And I struggled a lot with that, but in the end, the people who the movie rights went to are the people who made the Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns movies, and I'm so grateful to them, and I believe in them so much, and I felt included in every part of that process.
Yeah.
Authors always have horror stories about the movies, and I have some horror stories, but with both those movies, it was really just beyond lovely. Everyone was so nice. I felt really included in the whole process. And also, when I was wrong, which I often was, people would tell me I was wrong, which is important too. So, you know, like a lot of times I feel when I'm in that process.
What do you mean wrong?
Like, I wanted them to make it more different from the book in both cases. There were places where I wanted it to be more different from the book, and they really wanted to stay close to the book, and They were right in that,
yeah.
I think. So in both cases, there were little things like that where, you know, I was able to have a conversation with the screenwriters and kind of come to an agreement about it. But yeah, it was just a really dreamy process. I have no complaints, and I liked both movies.
Cool. Do you view them as the same story, or do you separate them in your
mind?
Oh,
that's a good question, man. That's interesting. I mean, I do think the book is the book and the movie is the movie, but they are the same story, and I think I probably would have answered that question differently 5 years ago, but I do think they're the same story, and I just think different with kind of the same story as told through, you know, the lens and vision of different people.
Yeah, cool. Well said. Well said. You know, actually, my favorite book-to-movie adaptation was Life of Pi.
Oh, it's a great one.
I really like it.
Same people who made The Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah,
one of whom
is from Indianapolis.
Oh, really? Awesome.
It's true. Erin Siminoff, she went to Orchard. So, there you go.
Shout-outs to Orchard.
Yeah, so she in fact came to Indianapolis to watch a Pacers game and took me out to coffee, and I'd had so many terrible Hollywood experiences by this time. This is right after we sold The Fault in Our Stars movie rights. She took me out to coffee, and she was like, we're going to get this movie made, and people are going to love it. And I was like, whatever. I've heard that 1,000 times from frickin' Hollywood people. And she was not wrong. So, yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, I liked Life of Pi a lot, too.
Yeah?
What's the worst one you've ever seen?
Oh, the worst one. I was crushed by Harry Potter, like I said.
Those are pretty good movies. It was just the Hermione issue?
It was the Hermione stuff. Once I got over that,
yeah.
I think I had to learn to get over it.
And right.
Why do I want to go to a movie and then sit there and just bitch the whole time about...
Right. Hermione.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
every time someone says her name, you just boo.
but yeah, so I had to get over that and maybe think, okay, this is a team's idea of what this story was. Maybe appreciate
right.
it for how someone does that. I've heard Dune was a terrible movie.
I haven't seen
so
it.
I don't think I'm gonna.
I'm sure you wouldn't like it.
Don't think I'm gonna watch that. Well,
yeah.
on the subject of film, you also tell stories through lots of different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
Vlog Brothers, your YouTube channel, Crash Courses, which I've been watching a little bit lately, Mental Floss, a bunch of other stuff. What fulfillment do you get out of that and different from writing, vice versa?
Yeah, well, for me, writing is extremely isolating and, you know, it involves years of work, and it's fun, and I love it, and I, you know, I look forward to writing every day that I get to do it, but it's also very quiet, and it's hard. You don't hear responses. You don't, you know, you're really alone with the story for extended periods of time, whereas when you make a video, you know, you can come up with the idea, and you can shoot the video, and you can edit it, and you can, you know, be having a conversation about it later that day. And so it's much better for building communities. And that's something my brother and I have always found really fascinating. How can online spaces and online platforms be used to build communities that can be productive and positive? I know that these days especially, there's a lot of tremendously toxic communities online. But you know, Hank and I have been doing this since 2007, and we've seen things be good on the social internet, and we've seen them be bad. We've never seen them be this bad, but I do think that there is some value in that. I do think that there are communities that you can build that can be part of what holds a person up and makes them feel okay in their world. When I was a kid, you know, when the internet was green letters on a black screen, it was a huge gift to me because I did feel so far outside, you know, my real world. Like, I felt so far outside a lot of the kids I went to school with, and just like I couldn't get them to like me, basically, which of course is precisely why they didn't like me, because I was trying way too hard. But on the internet, I could connect with people who were interested in the stuff I was interested in and who didn't judge me for being into the stuff I was into, and who, you know, were just a really supportive community. And so I think Hank and I have tried to find ways to build and foster those kinds of communities that can be really, really productive and positive, starting on Vlog Brothers. And then when the opportunity to make Crash Course came along, you know, we've always wanted to make educational video that was free. I've always felt like, I mean, even when Hank and I were in college, I remember talking to him about how all these educational videos that schools have to pay so much money for and students often have to rent or whatever, like, this should all be available free somehow. So that was really making a dream come true for us.
Oh, that's awesome. And with Crash Course, I think you say in one of the videos I heard that you partner with your high school history teacher.
Yeah, my high school history teacher.
To help write a lot of the content. That's awesome.
Yeah, he wrote the World History Series.
That's really cool. He obviously had somewhat of a positive impact on your life to go back in
time
and reach out.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, so many of my teachers. One of the weird things about being a teacher is that you have this huge impact on someone's life, and then at the time, they don't recognize the impact that you're having because they're so busy, like, being too cool for school and, like, showing up 20 minutes late and not reading the books and whatever. And so you give them a C minus. Case of my high school history teacher. And then you think, like, oh, that was a failed relationship, you know? Like, that one didn't work. But in truth, like, he totally lit me up about history and got me excited about it. It's just that I wasn't ready then, you know? It's the same thing with my English teachers. The fact that they cared about me and they showed faith in me and they believed in me, even though I didn't display any potential whatsoever, even though I didn't seem like a student who, you know, I didn't seem like, oh, that extraordinary student who we should invest all of our teaching resources into because look at this kid, he's really going to be something. It was like, okay, well, here's another C student, you know, and I've been teaching for 37 years, I've had a lot of these, and still they cared about me. And in a way, the fact that they still cared about me meant as much to me as what I learned in school. It told me that, you know, that I guess I was worth it, and that meant a lot to me and made me feel like maybe I could be a good student.
Oh, that's awesome. I had an awesome junior year English teacher in high school, Nate Nakadade.
Oh, great name.
Awesome name. And he wrote for, like, the World Surfing Magazine.
Oh, wow.
As a freelancer, and would tell these incredible stories of being in these remote parts of the world, catching waves.
Wow.
Like, what's catching a wave like? Yeah, he had a very positive impact.
Do you remember any of the books you read?
Books we read, yeah. We read Hemingway that year.
Oh, yeah.
For Whom the Bell Tolls, and then he sort of let us pick, so Sun Also Rises, Old Man and the Sea. I got into Hemingway that year. Movable Feast. Yeah, right. So now I imagine that all writers do what Hemingway did, which is, like, grab their child, you know, go down to the cafe on the street,
yeah,
and then sit down for, like, 8 hours and write, and don't let anybody talk to them.
Yeah,
and then, you know, sort of have their little kid in the.
Yeah, the kid is the the detail in a Movable Feast that I find the least believable.
Cool.
Like, what kind of Buddha baby was this? I just, like, stared into the middle distance for 8 hours while Papa, you know, wrote about masculinity and bulls.
Seriously. Well, what's your day like then?
Yeah, I wake up in the morning, I go to my local cafe at 86th and Ditch. It's called Starbucks.
Can you walk there or do you drive?
I mean, can I walk there? Yes. Do I drive? Yes. Yeah, most days I write in the morning and then I go into the office in the afternoon and do everything else, podcasts and videos and, you know, just the, like, paperwork and, you know, all that stuff that goes along with life. I thought somehow I would be able to escape paperwork if I worked in a creative field, but that has not proved to be the case. So I try to divide my days into twos. It doesn't always work that way, but yeah, that's how it works. What about you?
Yeah. Wake up, think about football, drive into football,
yeah,
have meetings about football,
yeah,
work out for football.
Yeah. Maybe do some press stuff for football.
Yeah, I'll do some press stuff for football. No, I really enjoy these days, actually. There's very strict rules in the NFL offseason. So we're only allowed 4 hours of work in our facility, and we go in and meet for a couple hours. We've got a new head coach, you might find this interesting, actually. A new head coach, and he brings in a new offense, and it's like learning a new language.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so there's, like, new words for everything.
Really? Like,
yeah.
Even the, like, abbreviations or whatever that they have for,
yeah,
different formations,
yeah, so,
and stuff?
A play call tells, generally, it has multiple parts. You know, one part is tell everybody where to line up. The second part is tell everybody sort of run or pass play. If it's a run play, it tells what type of scheme the big guys up front, you know, how they're going to handle the guys and where the running back's going to, you know, where we're going to try to let them go. If it's a pass play, it tells the receivers which routes to run. It also tells us what protection we're using. And so learning the new words is really, it can be tough because I've had a couple offenses now, and so I always try to recall back to what I know, but it's like a mishmash of right. some weird stuff, like Bruce yeah. Arians and Pep Hamilton. And
right, it's like learning Spanish and then learning French.
Yeah,
and
you're together.
Like, yeah, ue le baño. But then, like, if you make that mistake, instead of, like, just not knowing where the bathroom is, like, you get sacked. Like, yeah. It's a pretty high-stakes language learning.
But the stakes of not knowing where the bathroom are high as well.
That's true. Let's not kid ourselves. I picked a poor example. You're right.
Let's not kid ourselves. And then we get to come home and have good food and, hang out, read John Green books, yeah. watch John Green movies, watch Crash Courses. Crash Courses is really... Crash Courses or course? Singular?
However you want to say it.
Well, I want to say it.
If I learned anything from this Hermione thing, yeah. it's not to prescribe your pronunciation.
It's really worth watching if you have a chance. There's some awesome educational videos, but they're really fun and they're very engaging.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
I noticed too that you guys stop the videos and then your head ends up like. Yeah. 6 inches to the left, 6 inches to the right.
It's a jump cut.
And your hair ends up...
My hair changes in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. My hair...
It's cool.
It's like there's a wind blowing, but there isn't. It's just between every shot, I'm like, oh, God, is this bad? And then it's different. And then the next shot, I'll be like, ah, Stan, I'm not sure if that worked. And then, yeah. So that's what it is.
So that's your thought spiral
in the
Crash Course.
Yeah, the other thing, Stan always makes fun of me. Stan co-created Crash Course with me. He always makes fun of me because I insist on doing like the same shot like 6 or 7 times. So I'll say like the same thing about Alexander the Great. And I say it, I'm not an actor, so I say it the same exact way all 7 times. Yeah. And he's like, it's not changing. So I agree with you that it's not perfect. But the issue is that it's also not getting better.
It sounds like you need tough help.
Oh yeah, no, well, we've been together a long time, so. Yeah.
And your studio is in Indianapolis, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we shoot it all here. We used to shoot Crash Course. The stuff that you've been watching, we shot in a warehouse that warehoused warehouse parts. Which is the kind of thing that I just love. Like if you've read any of my books, you'll know that like nothing possibly could make me happier than a warehouse that houses warehouse parts, that ships warehouse parts to other warehouses when they need them. So don't be surprised if that's in my next book. But eventually, those they were really nice people, but they were like, listen, we've got to. You know, ship out the warehouse parts, and you guys need absolute silence, and so there's a bit of a tension here.
You can see it in the videos.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
Well, sometimes we would get a little mad. Yeah, we get a little snippy with each other, but yeah, no. So now we shoot in our offices, which is a lot easier.
Yeah, and you don't write in your office. You write at home or Starbucks.
I usually write at home or at a cafe. I sometimes write in the office. My writing chair is in the office. I've had the same Lazy Boy since I was 20. My mom got it for me on my 26th birthday, and it's really ugly. Like, the New Yorker called it hideous, and the Wall Street Journal called it dirty and oatmeal-colored. Somebody in our office wrote a list of all the ways that the press has talked about the Lazy Boy, and none of them are flattering, and... It used to be in our house, and it was so great because I like to write there. It's my favorite place to write, but it's so ugly, you know. And I'm married to a curator of contemporary art, and so now it's in the office.
Does it show up in your videos?
Very occasionally.
Or would we notice it if it
you know, does? You got to hold on to certain parts of yourself, Andrew. You know, so I don't like to be photographed in it or anything like that.
But you let the New Yorker write about it.
I mean, it was in the room. I didn't think they were going to, like, all that scene-setting stuff. Anyway, what were we talking about before this?
Yeah, let's get back to reading, actually.
Okay,
since
great.
Since we are in the Great American Read.
Yeah.
And you obviously read as a kid.
I did,
And I'm sure it shaped you in ways that maybe you don't even appreciate. And I think everybody who reads, it happens. What did you read as a kid?
You know, the first book I remember loving was Where the Red Fern Grows. You ever read that book?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, just, I mean, if you don't know about the dog thing in books, you know, that like if there's a dog at the start of the book, ... If you don't know that genre convention, which I didn't in third grade, devastating. You know, I mean, the worst... Oh, God, that book. I mean, I have no idea if it's good. I haven't read it since third grade. But in third grade, it was just beautiful. And then I also loved a book called Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, which is just a brilliant... That I have reread as an adult, and it is maybe even better now than it was in third or fourth grade. So, yeah,
What's that about?
I don't want to get into it too deeply, because it's been a while since I reread it.
Fair enough.
And there's no dog in it, unless there is. I don't want to find myself in another one of these situations where, at the end of it, they're like, "I'm sorry, but you just described the plot of
Red
Stuart Little."
Yeah, Stuart Little.
But yeah, I loved Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. And then what else? What else did I read when I was a little kid? You know, I liked picture books. Like, I wasn't a great reader to start. I read a lot of picture books and I remember liking those. It's been one of the great things about having kids is that you get to start rereading those books, you know?
Yeah.
So my son and I have been reading Harry Potter, which is just so fun, you know, because he doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's so fun. How about you? What did you read when you were a
kid? Yeah, anything and everything. I love the Narnia series. I've always been drawn to fiction.
Yeah.
And the Narnia series, Harry Potter. I'm running blank. I'm going to have to time out, consult my mom,
right.
And I'll get back on stage.
It's funny when you get put on the spot about, like, what's your favorite book or whatever, like, all information exits your mind at once. And you're in that state that, like, you're desperately
There's a word for it.
Is there?
Yeah, we had a...
Can you remember it? Or?
No, of course I can't remember it. I know this because we had an Engineering 14. It was statics at Stanford. I was a sophomore year. I was in it with my girlfriend, Nicole, and my buddy, Griff, who... We were chatting about.
Griff.
Yeah.
I got a funny Griff story.
Do you want to share it or no?
Yeah, I'll tell it real quick. So I met Andrew at a party, and he was with some very large members of the Colts offensive line and with a much smaller person. And I was talking to him, and I said, "How do you know Andrew?" And he said, "We went to Stanford together." And I said, "Oh, that's great." And he followed him out here, and he said, "Yeah, I guess so." And I said, "So... are you like his business manager?" And he said, "No, I'm a wide receiver for the Indianapolis Colts." But he's a very small man. So I felt pretty embarrassed. Then he did say, he said, "I do get that all the time." So that made me feel a little better.
Yeah.
So you were in this engineering class.
Yeah, and the professor... It was a very engaging class. He put you on the spot, and on the third day, he said a very long word, and he said, "That's what, you know, I know you know it, you're up here, you just, there's a condition when you get in front of people that everything leaves your mind."
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's so profound, too. Like the state that you're supposed to enter in meditation that I can never reach, I enter every time.
That's good.
I am, like, put
That's
on
really
the spot
funny.
In public. You know, and I'll be like, I can't, like, people will be like, "What are you reading now?" And I'll be like, "What am I reading now? Geez, right now I'm reading nothing. What was I reading last night? I don't know. Do I have a book? Are there any books in my house?" And then you, like, start scrolling through, like, all the things that, like, you're like, "Okay, I read that, but that was, like, a year ago. I can't say that." Yeah. So... I was scared that you're going to ask me what I'm reading right now, and I've been trying to think of an answer for that for 45 minutes.
You're stalling. It's nice. I like it. We were talking backstage too about The Orphan Master's Son.
Oh my God!
A book we have both read. That book.
Yeah. I mean, if you haven't read that book, go get it right now. It is amazing. It's a novel of North Korea that is also a novel of long distance rowing, and it is it is incredible. It is so, like, it's one of those books where, as a writer, I read it and I was just sort of, like, jealous the whole time. Just like, oh, that's amazing. How do you How do you pull that off? I love that book. It's really, really wonderful.
You know, it absolutely is. I know with reading, I think, thinking about The Orphan Master's Son and also Turtles All the Way Down, I read them back to back.
Oh, great.
And they both hold up very, very well next to each other. The word that kept coming to mind was perspective, because in The Orphan Master's Son, I really felt like I was a North Korean man who's just trying to survive, and then his world gets totally challenged at different ways, and he evolves, and priorities change, and yeah, I felt it. There's a scene in the book where they're flying on a plane, these North Korean dignitaries, to Texas to go meet with a senator from Texas, and that's, I guess, based on how we used to do talks with North Korea. North Koreans would fly to New Mexico to Governor Bill Richardson's ranch, you know, of all places, and they
really
would talk. Yeah, I guess this is how they, because there was no ambassadorial relationship with the country. But they're on a plane flying to Texas, and a minister gets up and briefs, you know, the sort of the hero of the book and the other doctors, ministers on the plane, and gives them a briefing about America and who Jesus is and race relations and what a football is and why dogs sleep in a house and why they feed dogs food and why they bike to nowhere or walk for their own pleasure. And I was reading it and thinking, man, that's weird. Why do dogs live in homes?
Right. Why would you just walk in a circle?
Yeah. Who needs to exercise? What is the point of that?
Right,
but
yeah.
But yeah, I totally felt, and then also in Turtles All the Way Down, I keep coming back to this. I felt a little bit like what a high school girl must go through that maybe isn't the most popular girl or is down on herself. And I think that's why reading is also so important is because, and I've talked with some folks about this, my parents especially. I know I only live one life, and it's my life. And I think reading allows you to get a little slice of a different perspective
Totally.
Of someone else's life. And I think that's so, so powerful. And I really feel for those who maybe can't experience anything else, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's such a problem to be stuck inside of one consciousness for your entire time on this planet, right? Because I will never be able to see the world out of anybody else's eyes. I totally yeah. agree with you. And even the people who are closest to me, you know, and who I love and know well and you know, want to know better, I still think of in the context of myself, right? Like when you describe my spouse, my children, my parents, it's still in the context of me. But when you're reading The Orphan Master's Son or, you know, any book, really, I just tried to think of a second book. I couldn't. When you're reading that book or another book, you don't think of those characters as your anything, right? You think of the world from inside their worldview, and of course, it's not magic. It doesn't mean that you can perfectly imagine what it's like to be someone else, or that you can, you know, become infinitely empathetic. There are limits to it, and we have to be super conscious of that and listen to the real lives of real people, not just the fictional lives. But I do think it is a way into empathy to be asked to see the world from someone else's perspective, to see the world as they see it, to fear their fears, and to love their loves. And I really find that transformational in my life, not least because, you know, in a lot of times in my life, it's been profoundly uncomfortable for me to be inside of my body because I haven't been able to escape these obsessive thoughts. And mm-hmm. and so it's a real, reading has always been a real gift to me.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. What makes you excited about Indianapolis, about what you're working on, about the future?
I love the month of May here.
Yeah, so do I.
You know?
So do I.
I love the race. I love 350,000 people coming together for a secular occasion to celebrate fast cars and Miller Lite. That's what comes to mind. It's probably not the, most delicate way to put it, but I do love the month of May here, and I'm working on, you know, when I finished Trolls All the Way Down, it was a tough book to write in a lot of ways, and to be honest, kind of a tough book to promote too, because I did, you know, have to talk about myself and my experiences with this stuff, which is, I don't want to be embarrassed about it. I don't want to feel like there's anything wrong with having a health problem, but it's still uncomfortable to talk about sometimes. And so I think on the other side of that, I thought, I don't know that I want to jump in right to trying to write another book. It was 6 years between The Fault in Our Stars and Turtles All the Way Down. And so I'm taking time right now to write other stuff, just writing a little podcast that's sort of fun, just kind of mostly for myself. And so I'm just trying to focus on writing stuff I like and not putting too much pressure on myself.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. That's awesome to hear. Well, I'm running out of questions.
Yeah, well, we can ask the audience. I also have no idea. For all I know, it could be 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
I don't have a watch. There's no... What time is it? I mean, it's almost exactly an hour.
55
Andrew.
Minutes? Perfect. Well,
like, look at this guy. I mean, he should host a talk show. When you're done.
Yeah. I've got to play some football first.
After a long career, yeah.
Awesome. John, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks,
I hope
everybody.
You guys enjoyed
thank
it.
You
yeah,
so much for supporting for WFYI.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew. Awesome. Thanks, guys. Andrew. Thank you, guys. Yeah. Thanks.